and welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I'm your host. Since we aired our episode unpacking the NSSF Act a couple of months ago and the contentions around it, there's been a lot of interest from our listeners in the world of pensions. Many listeners have gone back to keep listening to that episode. And on today's episode, we'd like to discuss the role of stakeholders in pensions. In studio with me to discuss this topic is George Oyuga. George is a pensions consultant. Welcome, George.
Thank you very much, Jean. And I appreciate the opportunity to have me here.
We're very glad to have you.
Great.
So before we begin, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your work in pensions.
Well, Jean, you know, it's normally very hard for one to speak about themselves. So I think I'll approach it this way. Let's talk about my career in the pension industry. Well, I began my career around 17 years ago in the local industry. I've worked with the private sector pension administration firms, the likes of Minette, the likes of Alexander Forbes then, NWealth, and then Zamara currently. And I've also worked with the public sector pension administration for around 2.5 years. And this was CPF Financial Services Limited some years back as well. Then I also worked with the approved issuer pension services providers. These are like they offer what we call the pension deposit administration offer within the industry. So I was there as well. And then also in the private sector asset management. So that in terms of my work career. But in the industry, I've also had several roles. One of them is I've served as a pension committee member in the Association of Kenya Insurers. I've also served as a committee member in APTAC. APTAC is the Association of Pension Trustees and Administrators of Kenya. Then I am currently a trainer and a facilitator at the Trustee Development Program of Kenya. It's TDPK. TDPK is the industry certification for trustees, who look after the pension schemes in Kenya. And then I'm also currently serving as a board member of the Center for Corporate Governance Alumni Network, as the chair of the Finance Administration and HR Committee. And then I've also had some few stints here and there as a speaker in various industry conferences organized by different stakeholders. So maybe that would be my work in pensions. Someone else may put it better, I don't know.
Well, like, what it does tell me is that you've had a very broad depth of experience and you've gone in and looked at pensions both from the private sector and from the public sector.
Exactly.
And that will guide me to my next question. I think it's been argued that the provision of retirement benefits, at least historically, has been limited to the public sector workers. And no, you, when you look at pensions, you just think about anybody who's worked in Serikali. What can be done to change this and what has been happening to change this and incorporate larger segments of the private and informal sectors?
Well, for pension arrangements and the like, yes, the more formal part of it, you'd see it in a more elaborate way in the private sector or public sector workers, simply because the way people are employed, these are entrenched within their contracts and the like. So people just plug in, by the way, they go through the deductions, all that. Some of them don't even know until they actually retire. But one of the things that I would want to say is that the quality of life among the Kenyan elderly people would actually be a very good measure of what our decency as Kenyans is. And it calls for us to look at how to package the pension conversation so that it is inclusive. One does not need to be in a formal arrangement to access a pension savings platform. Why? Because when it comes to retirement, everybody retires because time is a age is a function of time. So the seconds will roll to minutes, they'll roll to hours, they'll roll to days, weeks, months, years, then someone gets to retirement. So every time somebody gets to the retirement age and they do not have a platform to be able to save for retirement, then chances are that they'll be exposed to all those things we want to run away from, old age poverty and the challenges that are there. I know when you talk about informal sectors, we are talking about that part of a country's economy that is not taxed or its activities are not included in a country's gross national product and the like. But there are things that the government is doing in terms of the regulatory framework, in terms of the policy amendments and the like. So those ones are there. Challenges are still there as well, but I think it's a conversation that is ongoing.
Well, it's something interesting that you've just said, that a lot of the formal workers don't even know that they are part of a pensions program. They just get in and it's one of the things that was listed that must be deducted. And in fact, they don't even think about it until the day they retire. Then they find out.
Exactly.
So what can we do to educate people? Because I feel like there's a bit of education that needs to happen there so that people, even in the formal employment, know that I am part of a pension scheme. These are my entitlements. And at the end, you know, like, in the same way in America, I think they have a very robust education about their 401k.
Yes.
They have a very, very robust culture of understanding what it means, how they're contributing to it, how they can increase it. What can we do to change that about Kenya and to not only educate those who are already in the schemes, but those who are not in the schemes to help them have, and I think you've mentioned this before, a saving culture, which is not common to, to us. Yeah.
True. Well, there are two approaches here. There is those who will get in a formal setup, and then there are those who are in that informal space. So in the informal space, of course, the conversations around how to do financial inclusion, education, financial literacy, and the like. Let me pack that a bit and come back to the formal sector where things are a bit structured. I think that war can be won easily if we are able to have these conversations as early as when one is joining unemployment. So when you're onboarding somebody, and I think I've been very, very vocal to try and help HR practitioners at least appreciate this, that your induction program is not complete if you do not offer financial literacy. Because many times when people join organizations or institutions, you want to teach them how to access the system. You want to tell them about policies, this is your leave, these are your benefits and all that and all that. And we forget one major thing, that this person at this particular point is so eager to learn things that can improve their life in this new work environment. So financial education is key. And it is within it that we should be able to actually spell out the pension conversation, the need for savings, and the whole financial literacy as a docket. Savings is just one component of it. I've always talked about the WISE concept. And this WISE concept is that for the W, you have wealth management. For the I, you have investments. For the S, you have savings. And for the E, you have earnings. And each of them is actually a standalone module on its own. So using that WISE concept, it forms a whole spectrum of financial literacy that you can offer to an employee. And I think that is the first step of winning that war.
So it doesn't go wrong, it starts wrong. And at that time, and you're very right, usually the youngest employees are the most impressionable. And
yes.
In fact, all you could impress upon them when they're starting out to have that WISE model where they're looking at their wealth, they're looking at their investments, they're looking at their savings, and they're looking at their earnings and how to increase those earnings. And because the earnings will increase with time, with time comes more, then they'll be able to have inculcated that culture, by the time we'll be getting to their older years, it won't be a problem.
And then, you know, like what you said, when one is already in employment, we struggle with certain things, like even for pension schemes, you ask them to come for AGMs. They're like, that's not for them. It's for those who are almost retiring. So even AGM attendance is very, very poor across the different schemes within our sector. And I think it mirrors the same picture even elsewhere when you go there. There's a detached kind of engagement, you know, among the young people. But if you can take advantage of the fact that when one is just onboarding, they're very vulnerable. You know, those guys, you can even ask them, bring a copy of your birth certificate, they will bring. Bring a copy of your last receipt you spent in the supermarket, they will attach. So that is the time that you need to get them and tell them, hey guys, you need to learn about financial education. You know, to now know, as you start this journey today, maybe you're joining and you're coming from a job that was paying you something lower. So how do you manage this increase, you know? Because for some people, you actually would want to spend all the additional cash and bring it back to manageable levels, you know, the level that you're used to, you know? So for some, we say in Swahili, they pigia mwili pole, you know? or Asante based on the experience. Yeah.
Now, pension practitioners, and I want to say this, what role can pension practitioners now play in tracking the changing pension environment and pushing for pension reforms? Why do I say this? Africa in general and Kenya in particular are known to be a young population. Mm-hmm. We say that a good percentage, I'm not sure exactly how much it is, but I'm sure it's more than 40% of our population is mm-hmm. under the age of 35. So yes. We are technically mm-hmm. in the bracket that is defined as youth.
Exactly.
But that's not always going to be the case. And
true.
And as you rightly said, this conversation, this pension conversation is viewed as one for the nearly dead, the retiring, mm-hmm. and the old.
Yeah.
But time and age catches yeah. up with all of us.
Yes.
What can practitioners do, stakeholders do, to track this changing environment and foresee maybe in 2060, maybe mm-hmm. in 2045,
yeah.
when this demographic, mm-hmm. this youth dividend we will now mm-hmm. have, will now be an old dividend, and we'll be looking at
true.
Similar populations like Japan and China, where mm-hmm. people are much older than they are younger.
Exactly. And I like the way you position it, that it is a dividend. Why? Because it is an advantage that most of us stakeholders in the industry are not taking advantage of. Because one of the key things that this age group comes with is the thirst for knowledge. And so that space, we've allowed it to be filled with everything else except this conversation that is very, very important, that will actually determine how they will end their financial journeys. You know, and you know, in life, it's not about how much you earn. It is about how you manage the little that comes into your hands. That is where the solution is. So for us as stakeholders, rather than sit and wait, we should see more of us in the field, skin in the game, where we are able to actively engage these people. They are thirsty for social media content. Are we in those spaces? Are we part of the conversation? They are looking at how can we access information. They are looking at how can they listen to, like now, a podcast like this one. Are we able to come into the space and give them the information that they want? Because that is what will actually do what? Change their lives as they continue. So calling on stakeholders, are we able to even package and say, this is my budget, and not just being in social media because I want to sell. Be in social media because I want to empower. And when you empower people, they will look for what matches their needs. And that's now will elevate you from being a product pusher to a solution provider. Because with solutions, somebody will always come shopping to try and see how they can match their needs. And there are certain things that are also there, like access to social security programs is a basic right under our constitution here in Kenya. So if we are able to be seen to be aiding the same and access and all that, financial inclusion, literacy and all that, then we'll be doing our part rather than just waiting for things to happen. And can I also fault most of our stakeholders? Do you know they stay, or we, let me say we, we stay away from conversations such that even legislative changes affecting our own space get us by surprise. We are not there. When it comes to this public participation, you know, all those kind of things you find, even our regulator at times asks people, come, we will be discussing these proposals, policy changes and the like. Guys are not there. Then when the legislation has now been rolled out, that's when we want to react. It's
you're
too late.
Up.
Exactly, you know. Yeah, so let's be in the game. Let's have the scheme in the game. Let us participate. Let us be seen to be actively involved in all this.
Now, there's another thing that pension schemes do. And pension schemes, since you're a long-term saving mm-hmm. platform, mm-hmm. you accumulate large amounts of money.
Yes.
And you can't let money sit. I mean, mm-hmm. even just if you were to go back to our Anglo-Saxon Christian roots, the person with the talents and buried them
yes.
was cursed. So you must
yes.
mm-hmm. invest.
Mm-hmm.
So what role can pension schemes play in economic development? I mean, traditionally, there are mm-hmm. some safe spaces mm-hmm. that you invest in.
Yes.
What have you done in the past and how has it contributed to the economy of the country?
Well, we've had what we can call traditional investments. I don't know why they are traditional, but we've ended up that way. Why? Because for a very, very long time, there was very little conversation around expanding the scope of investable securities. So you'll find people playing in the interest-bearing assets, mainly government securities, term deposits, and all those kinds of things. Then the next available opportunities to say we are now in the equity space. If you look at the regulations, retirement benefits regulations, there's what we call the Table G. And Table G lists a good number of investable securities. So that space has been expanding now to include things like infrastructure, things like property, things like private equity, you know, all those are now in there. But because people have not been socialized to at least be able to embrace the same, we are still stuck with what is old. I'll tell you that we even have derivatives as one of the spaces where pension schemes can invest in. But if you walk across different pension schemes, you'll ask yourself, which ones have an investment policy statement that has been tailored to appreciate the fact that there's an opportunity within derivatives? So those things are rolled out, but because they are not in the traditional, maybe we are stuck in traditions, I don't know. People still just want to stick into the old and that what is there. But a new wave is coming up now. And part of it is to say, can we have more of the stakeholders in the pension industry speaking about these things, speaking about alternative investments, for example, such that even if they come and part of their feature is like they deliver from a longer term horizon, if stakeholders can appreciate that, then we can be able to counter the other things. Like, for example, the tenure of trustees in the pension schemes, I would say it also contributes to that. Because if I'm in the office and I'm only there for 3 years, I don't even know whether I'll be given another term to now serve my second term. Most of my decisions will actually be very short term. And you know, and some of these opportunities that are there, they are long term. And when we look for a way of managing that bit, then we'll have scored. Because a trustee today can actually make a decision that they know will last in perpetuity, because it's not just a matter of me seeing the results when I'm in office. I'll be able to also see the results later, someone else harvesting or reaping the decisions we made 10, 15 years ago. And some of them are very lucrative. The monies we are receiving here for some projects, some of them very impactful to our economic development, are actually monies consolidated from other markets. And they come here packaged like it's a private equity firm and the like. But behind the scenes, it's those pension schemes maybe who are actually coming to reap opportunities that are here with us. So I think there's some work that needs to be done there.
And now I'm going to look at this from the perspective of now a pensioner and say it in this way. Well, whereas we've spoken about the need for education of pensioners on just the getting into a pension to begin with, let's now look at from the perspective of a, I'd say an awake, an aware pensioner. So, and I understand why pension schemes stick with the traditional. This is my life savings. It is a nest egg that I am keeping for my older years. There's an expectation that you will not be willy-nilly in how you deal with it. That I have entrusted this money with you. You will grow it as best as you can, but you'll also be conscientious in the investments that you make, such that I do not have the likelihood of losing it. Because again, that can lead to class action suits.
I know.
You know.
Yes.
So, how again do pension schemes educate the pensioners on how you're managing this consistent investment that they're making with you?
Okay. It's an interesting conversation, especially in a year like this one, because in a year like this one, we have pension schemes that would invest directly into the market. This is the time they are really bearing the brunt of what happened last year. Last year, on average, a pension scheme gave a return of around 1.8%. You see? And those are schemes that were invested directly into the market. We call them the segregated funds, you know. And why it's such a big challenge is because the entire market has been conditioned to always look at things from the shorter term. People are not looking at the journey or the longer term view of everything, because it's one thing to maybe today talk about a scheme that gave you 1.8% last year, gave you 8% the previous year, gave you 5% the year before that one, gave you 12% the year before that one. So you see, that fluctuation reflects performance in the market. But at the end of the day, the aggregate journey translates to something like 8%. But someone can actually beat you for the 1.8 that you've given them today, because it is very short term. What did you give me last year? And they make drastic decisions this year and they change their investment strategies and all those kind of things, simply reflecting that the understanding of the journey. And can I give an analogy? Please. Today, you want to go to Mombasa by road, is it?
Yes.
Mombasa is how many kilometers from Nairobi? Maybe around 400. Let's approximate and say 400, is it?
Yeah.
So with those 400, and you are doing, let's say, for example, 100 kilometers per hour, mm-hmm. consistent, it will take you how many hours? 4 hours to get to Mombasa. But if someone gets to Mombasa in those 4 hours, the truth of the matter is that their speedometer was not stuck at 100 throughout. There are places where there was a bump, so they did 30, you know. There's a place where it was very, very clear. They were doing 120, you know, all that. But on average, they're like, it takes me around 4 hours to get there, is it? But anyway, let's discuss a more safer speed. Exactly. 100 is just too high, is it?
So we take it down to 80. Exactly.
Let's take it down to 80, you know. So if you take it down to 80, then you're discussing maybe 80, 400, maybe something close to around 6 to 7 hours, is it? So if you're talking about 6 to 7 hours and you get there, then someone will tell you, on average, yeah, you will take that, but in practical sense, there are places you are doing 120, you are doing 80, you are doing 50, you are doing 30, you know, at some point you maybe even stopped completely. But on average, where are you? That journey is what people need to judge or gauge or measure at any given time during their pension journey. So you look back and say, over the last 10 years, how has this space delivered? Has it given me a return that is above inflation? Then I think I'm in the right space. But if people keep on making decisions and
short-term decision based off of what happened in the
previous, they miss out. Exactly. Yes, yes.
I like that. Mm. Now, I want to now come down to the last question that we're going to ask you today. And this is with regard to the legislative changes that happened this year.
Okay.
So this year, how has the implementation of the NSSF Act 2013 impacted the local pension industry? Is it too soon to say what has happened?
What has happened?
Yeah.
Well, for a very, very long time, we have been struggling with a low pension coverage. I think the NSSF Act of 2013 is a blessing in disguise to the market. Why? Because people who did not have access to pension, did not have access to a savings platform, now will have it because legislation has pushed it. So we are foreseeing better journeys financially for people as they get towards retirement, because almost everybody who is, for example, first of all, earning will actually end up having some saving spot, which is a good thing. So has it now given people the chance to turn their focus and say, by the way, it's good to save for retirement? I think that's a positive and it's a plus, because you have more people now within that space and they are covered. That's a plus for the industry. The other thing that is a plus for the industry is that the level of savings for Kenyans will go up, meaning we will have more liquidity within our industry, which then can find its way into investments and borrowing around the country, which is a good thing. Then the other beautiful thing is that with everybody now participating, there'll be more voices that can now choose for more reforms. And I think that will be coming. Because before NSSF, you and me in a pension scheme would get a tax relief on the first 20,000 shillings that are there. As NSSF continues growing, because, you know, every given year, the national average earning that is used to calculate the base and also the minimum wage that will also be used to calculate the wage will keep on shifting year one, year two, year three, year four, year five. So by year five, and we keep the 20,000 tax-free limit at that point, I think there'll be some push to kind of want to enlarge that. And I think that would be a positive as well. Yeah, so that is coming. And of course, many more people are now, will find themselves saving.
I like that you're looking at it from a very positive perspective. And I think as a pension practitioner, yes, you can see the positives there. As a pensioner, I'm just thinking, you want more of my money? Money I could have used now, but I see where you're coming from. Yeah. Now, as my final question, let's look forward, forward looking, and let's see, what do you see the future of pensions looking like, especially for stakeholders? What opportunities and what threats do you see in the next 3 to 5 years?
3 to 5 years. I'll start with the positives. Yeah, which are the opportunities. Now, for opportunities, we will have more savings in the market. That is a plus. When we have more savings, it means schemes will have more money. We will have some agitation towards expanding the investable securities. People will be looking at where do we park these, where do we save these, and the like, and all that. Then the other thing again is that as stakeholders also seek to differentiate their pension provision or offering within the market, there are chances that we will have a lot of conversations to enhance the employee benefit package or bouquet. So that you say, I know this is basic. So if I can get it, for example, with the National Social Security Fund, so what makes you different? So private sector will always want to say, I know those ones are here, but we are a step higher or a step beyond and above them, is it? So we will see a lot of new developments, value add services to those who are saving and the like. And I like that. On the other hand, the only threat that I foresee there would be the threat to employers. Why? Because as the 6% keeps on adjusting itself with the national average earnings and you know, the minimum wage levels and the like for tier one and tier two, the pressure on employers will be enhanced to some extent, because what used to be your budget for pension last year will no longer be a budget for pension today. And for individuals, please never look at this differently. Because, Gene, if you have a dress that has two pockets and you take money from one pocket and put to the other, it doesn't mean you have
mine.
Exactly. Money is still yours, is it?
Yes.
So whether the money is reflected in your net that comes home or in your savings pot, which is still part of your savings, please celebrate the fact that it is still within your territory. And by it being there, you are attracting more money from the employer, because the employer will have to match that 6 to 6%. So that's another thing. The only other threat that I also see, other than the budget bulging for employers, is that pension schemes that have been enjoying some comfort because the way they were structured was from a cost perspective. You know, initially, an actuary would sit down and tell you, based on the way you are proposing to pay your people, the tenure of service and all those kind of things, you are comfortable to give them a healthier net replacement ratio of maybe up to 70%. So for them, employee contribution will be X, employer contribution will be Y. That was in the era of defined benefit schemes. When we came to defined contribution schemes, Gene, everybody started looking at that conversation from a cost perspective. So I would get calls, for example, in the industry to say, George, we are looking at setting up a pension scheme. What is the average contribution rate in the market? And you tell them the average is at around 6%. Then they tell you, is there anything that bars me from doing 3? And I tell them, no. What you need to look at is how are you envisioning the journey to end for your staff, you know? So that those who are approaching it from a cost perspective, I think NSSF 2013 has caught up with them. So for them, a challenge. Those 3% must go up and match at least the 6. Let's start there. Then the other thing again is those who set up schemes where the scheme was running autonomously on its own, is it?
Yes.
And then NSSF was also going on its own. You know?
I remember that.
It was 200 shillings. It was very easy. How many staff do I have? 100 times 200? Take the money to NSSF. But now we will get to a point whereby you are almost operating two schemes parallel to each other. So if you did not envision that a time will come and you now need to have the NSSF contribution integrated within the pension space that you are in, then you are in for even a bigger budget. Because if you're an employer, then you're talking about the normal scheme where you have a promise contractually with your staff at 5 or 6 or 7%, you will do that and you've not integrated. As NSSF grows, you will also have to grow with it. So that's another challenge that I foresee. Yep.
Well, but I love that all these challenges are not for me, the individual. They are for my employer. And that is for them to think through.
Exactly.
But also, I like the fact that you said that there will be a lot of innovations.
Yep.
There will be a lot of innovations because the market must always innovate. And if the government has reached a certain level, the market must innovate more so that they always give a better offering than the government, which I like also. I like that as I grow older, because I will be one of those beneficiaries of all these good things, services and the benefits that will be available to me will be so much more robust.
Exactly.
So that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, George Oyuga. Thank you, George.
Thank you very much, Jean. I'm looking forward to more such engagements. I like this.
It is really nice. I do like it. So tell us what you think about this episode in the comment section of our social media pages or on email. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Badgama Advocates on social media. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast.